Thanks for setting up this session, Bruce, and inviting me. And I appreciate that you like my title. I was telling Bruce it started out as a little bit of a joke, but everybody should be allowed to have the fun title once in a while, right? We'll explain what I mean by sink, swim, or get out of the way. As sea level rises, and the forest floor can actually build up material. So if the sea level rise outpaces that buildup, I'm going to say it's sinking. Okay. If it's keeping pace with that sea level rise, then they're swimming. Okay. The third option is get out of the way. If they can't keep pace, there is the potential for them to migrate landward. In some places, they can migrate landward. Where I live in the Tampa Bay area, if they were to try to migrate landward, they would have to move into a condo, which is true in many places. Okay, so when we talk about mangrove forests, we talk about why they're important. We talk about ecosystem services. And often people will talk about ecosystem services in terms of storm protection and habitat. But I also want you to think about ecosystem services in terms of the carbon storage. Okay? So we're talking about carbon that is removed from the atmosphere by these plants and stored in the biomass and the soils. And the plots I have up here, we're comparing this salt marsh mangroves and seagrasses in this figure, which has been dubbed the blue carbon, the marine carbon pool, and comparing that to some other terrestrial forest here. And if you notice the scale over here, showing that the blue carbon is about 10 times higher annual burial rates on a per area basis than these other forest systems. Okay, so very, very substantial there. And then on the other side here, we're comparing the storage, again, on a per area basis. And this is from Donato et al. 2011, where they looked at some mangroves in the Indo-Pacific. And so this is the total carbon stored in a per area basis compared, again, to these other forests. And again, the mangroves are substantially more. And also note that from here down is what's below ground. Okay, so it's actually what's in the below the surface in the soils that is the most important pool. Okay, so our questions here, we want to know, how does the burial and storage of carbon respond to sea level rise and climate change? And so as sea level rises, and if we potentially lose these systems, then we will lose that annual carbon sink. Okay, but in addition to that, what about the carbon that's already buried there? Okay, in some places there's a substantial meters of peat that's already been buried in these systems. The potential to oxidize that material and send that carbon back into the atmosphere would represent a positive feedback to climate change. Okay, since and Bruce mentioned that we're from all over the place here, so I thought I'd give you a little idea of where I'm coming from. So this is the part of the peninsula in Florida, and I have several sites around the state where I'm working on mangrove forest projects. What I'm going to talk to you about today is right in here, which I've blown up over here, this section of Everglades National Park. And this is my largest project, and it's funded by the National Science Foundation Water Sustainability and Climate Program, hence the WSC, Water Sustainability and Climate. And we have three different transects going up these different rivers, the Shark, the Harney, and the Broad here. And so we have cores at each of these sites. And I'm going to point out station 5 down here, because I'm going to show you, the first data I'm going to show you is from that location. Okay, this is a picture taken from the mangrove forest right on the edge of the Gulf of Mexico. And to point out a few things you can see that's already taking place, you see some dead trees. Okay, we see some exposed roots back here. So we're already seeing some response to this, sea level rise. Okay, this is a tidal gauge data from Key West, Florida. And it's showing you a 2.3 millimeter per year rise going back to 1913. This is actually one of the longest tidal gauge data sets around. Okay, so we're seeing this rise in sea level. And so some of this loss is simply due to that greater inundation. But along with the higher water levels, we also get more energy. And in general, that energy comes in the form of waves. And when do we get most of our wave activities? We get tropical cyclones. Okay. Now, in Florida, it's been about a decade or so since we've actually had any tropical cyclones, but I can assure you they will return. And this figure over here I call my spider web plot. Okay. These are just a few of the tracks of some of the bigger storms that have come through the area. These are 3, 4, and 5 category hurricanes that have crossed the study area in the past 130 years or so. And over here, this was a big storm that came through in 2005 called Hurricane Wilma. And the eye of that storm passed just to the north of my study site. And when your hurricane comes in and it's swirling around like this, okay, so the area down here is actually what we refer to as the bad side of the storm. Okay, and so that bad side of the storm came right across the study area, with the eye being just to the north. Okay, a little bit on terminology and a few things to think about as we go through that, and that's this elevation, accretion, and time scale. Okay, so elevation, we're talking about a measure of the relative elevation change to some benchmark. Okay, so actual movement, vertical movement of the forest floor, and often this is measured with these things called SET, surface elevation tables, and that's what my colleague is doing over here. And so, slightly off the out of the picture, there's a rod that goes down into the bedrock, and he's got an arm that comes over here, and he's lowering these rods down to the surface of the forest floor. And he goes out repeatedly and makes these measurements, and you can see it rise up relative to that benchmark deep on the bedrock as time goes by. And that rise is a result of simply the addition of material, but we also have some other things we have to consider here, and that is, as you add more material, we'll get some compaction taking place. Also, this is highly organic material. There's degradation that takes place. And then as water comes in and goes out, and you hydrate and you dehydrate, you also have this shrink and swell that takes place. Okay. So it's important here, when you're making these measurements, or all these measurements, to think about time scale. Okay? So these SETs out in the Everglades National Park have been out there a long time for SETs in mangrove systems, okay? Over 15 years. Okay? And so that's a great, fantastic data set, but for the processes we're talking about, that's still a relatively short time period. Okay? Other ways to measure these things, we talk about accretion, which is the addition of material. We'll talk about that in millimeters per year, buildup of material. And we can do that on the short time scale as well with these marker horizons. And that's what you see here, where this white material is a feldspar material. So you lay out some type of foreign material that can easily be identified compared to the natural material. And you come back years later and core over the top of it, and simply with the calipers here measure how much material has accumulated on top of that. Okay, and again, that's a relatively short time scale. It depends on when you put the stuff out there. You can't go back in time. Okay, but what I'm going to show you today, I actually am going to go back in time. I'm going to use the naturally occurring radioisotope lead-210, and so we're going to look at dating this material on a 100-year time scale. And so with lead-210, we start out with radium-226, and it decays to radon-222, which is an inert gas. It diffuses into the atmosphere, where a few daughter products, it turns into lead-210, which is then removed from the atmosphere and adsorbs onto the particles, so it's a particle tracer. Okay, give you a little bit of background on how we collect these samples, and this is the low-tech, very low-tech approach. Okay, you take a PVC tube, you bevel the edges, okay, you take a 2x6 and a sledgehammer. Okay. Then the most important part is you need a grad student that's willing to hold that 2x6 while I pound it with a sledgehammer. Okay. And you notice the leaves are hiding his face here, so you can't actually see the fear in his eyes. I've yet to hit him. So we drive this in. Again, you just leave a little bit out the top, and then we have something we attach to the top of it that creates a vacuum. And you dig a little bit, and you muscle this thing out of the ground. Okay. Now, this slide I talk about job hazards. Okay. Some of these areas are pretty dense. They're hard to get into. So this might look like a nice place to step off the boat onto, except there's a 9-foot alligator sitting up here. Okay. Now, this area is also very interesting because right down the creek from where we had that 9-foot alligator, we had a saltwater crocodile about the same length. Okay. And then one of the things that bothered me the most are these guys. One site was literally infested with scorpions. Now, this is maybe a 13 or 14-foot saltwater crocodile. This was not out in the Everglades. Okay? This was behind a public library in Miami. And I had something new on my last expedition. We were actually working in the Keys, and we were in knee-deep water, surrounded by 15 or 20 sharks. Okay? And you can't tell the size of the shark here, which I kind of like about the picture. But it was about like this. And I thought it wouldn't be any problem. You know, like most fish, as soon as they see you splash and wade toward them, you see the flick of the tail and they're gone. Not the sharks. They were a little too curious. You literally had to shoo them away. But assuming you survive all of these hazards, you return to the lab, all your limbs intact, with your core. And what we do is we extrude that material, okay, and we slice it off at the desired intervals, and then we gamma count it in order to determine the lead-210. We actually determine what's called the excess lead-210. And so from that, we can run our dating models. And when we run the dating model, we end up with ages or times at discrete points in the core. So we can determine the mass over that depth, knowing that time, take the mass divided by time, it gives us a mass accumulation rate. We can then measure any components we like in that mass, multiply that percentage times the mass accumulation, and you have the accumulation for that given component. Okay? And so we can do that same thing with depth and end up with the accretion. Okay? Now, we also look at the accretion in two different ways. We look at just the raw accretion, okay, from the depth when we slice the intervals, and then we also look at a density-corrected values. And the density-corrected values, what we do is we look at the density at the deeper portion of the core, and we mathematically squeeze the top part of the core until it has that same density. Because we realize over time, we're going to see that compaction take place. And so what we're trying to do is look at that long-term result of adding that material, and also this is a way of sort of estimating what the long-term elevation change may be from that site. Okay, go back to the tidal gauge data. This is obviously 1913 when the tidal gauge data began there, to 2013, which is when we collected the cores. Okay? And so this NOAA plot shows you this 2.2 millimeter per year rise. And if you just look at this plot, it looks like a pretty nice line there. Fortunately, NOAA makes the data available, and we can look at that data in other ways. And if you look at a five-year running mean, you start to see all these different oscillations in there. So the periods where it goes up pretty quickly, it's kind of flat, it may even go down for a little while. And so looking at this, we decided that, well, we should examine these different time scales. So with the lead-210, we can do that. And so we decided to look at this, the whole record, the 100-year record, the 50-year, and the most recent 10-year period. And so this is that WSC5 site, and I call it the flux tower site because there's also an eddy covariance flux tower there. And over here, this is the tide gauge data. Okay, and so this is the 10-year, 50-year, and 100-year averages from the tide gauge data. And so we got six sites at this location. And if we look at the 100-year accumulation rates in millimeters per year, we see that all six of these locations at this single site are either matching or exceeding that tide gauge data. So fantastic. It's either keeping up or exceeding on the 100-year time scale. Looking at the 50, we basically see the same thing. There's a greater spread in the data, but once again, it's either matching or exceeding that rise in sea level over the 50-year time scale. Okay, not the same story on this 10-year period. Okay, and there has been a dramatic uptick over the last 10 years. And some of that may be the global acceleration of sea level rise, but most of it's a local oscillation, probably related to wind patterns and ocean circulation. But nowhere do we see the accumulation of material keeping pace with that 6.9 millimeter per year rise in sea level. Okay? And so this was actually published last year in a paper, Journal of Geophysical Research, Biogeosciences. Okay, I'm showing the same type of data here, the accretion data, but looking at all the sites I showed you on those three different transects across the three different rivers. And again, I'm showing you this is the Key West tide gauge data, that 2.2. And what we see on the 100-year time scale for the accretion rates is exactly that same value. Exactly, no lie. So you can't make up data like that. Exactly the same. And you'll see, you know, some places it's right on, some places a little above, some places quite a bit below. I'll talk about these areas. But the average for the whole system is exactly the same on the 100-year time scale. Basically the same thing on the 50-year time scale. Okay, we've got accretion at 2.7 millimeters per year, plus or minus 0.03, and that's the same as what we see in the tide gauge data. Okay. Now, if we move to the most recent 10-year period, you don't see a line. Okay, that's because it would be off the scale. Okay, nowhere are the rates matching that 6.9 millimeter per year rate that we see. Okay, in fact, our 10-year mean is 3.4 plus or minus 0.5. Okay, and I'll kind of give you the big picture answer to that, to my title, The Fate of Mangrove Forest. Okay, a system like this, if we get up, let's just, with this plus or minus, let's call this 4 millimeters per year. Okay, once we see a long-term sea level rise of 4 millimeters per year or more, the system will not be able to keep up with it. Okay, and there are many systems like this. Maybe there are a few riverine systems where there's a plentiful supply of inorganic material that may enhance this. But these systems that depend on the organic matter are not going to be able to keep pace with a long-term rate. And again, I'm not talking a single decade, but multi-decade-old acceleration in sea level. They're not going to keep pace. Okay? Now, I can be pretty confident in this statement because this most recent 10-year period, the system was optimized for having the highest rates. Okay, and that's because of Hurricane Wilma. We can track storm deposits in this system by looking at calcium. And so we ran some X-ray fluorescence using a core logger, and you can see these peaks that come out here, and this is, you know, visibly looking at the core, you can see these as well. Okay, so this was some of the marine marl that came in with the storm surge from Hurricane Wilma. Now, the addition of this material, you can cause an elevation change, but it really doesn't cause a long-term change in elevation. That's because it's dense and it starts to compact material. It doesn't add a lot because it's dense. But one of the big things it does is it brings in phosphorus in a phosphorus-limited system. So this may actually enhance the production of organic matter. Okay? And the next slide shows you why that's the key in this system. Plotting accretion versus organic matter. And this is the one-to-one line here. Okay? And we've broken this down into organic, which is the upstream, it's all organic material. The downstream, which also has that marine marl washed in, the inorganic material. And wherever you look, it's pretty much right on that one-to-one line. So it's the organic matter that is responsible for accretion in this system. Okay. Which finally brings us to actual organic carbon, showing you a similar plot and looking at the rates on different time scales. And of course, as you get more recent time period, you have higher rates, and that may be that the accumulation is actually enhanced at that time, or maybe you're just seeing fresher material. Okay, but what I really wanted to point out here is this area down here where I mentioned before when we were looking at the accretion rates, how it has, these are the lower ones, these are falling below the line, and all those come from right around this area, which is Tarpon Bay. And so this is this oligohaline ecotone area where salinities range from, say, 0 to 10 parts per thousand, and the surface and groundwater salinities have been increasing in the past years. And if we plot that out, we see higher rates downstream, higher rates upstream, and much lower around Tarpon Bay. And we're referring to this as the dip. Okay. Now, the truth is we have very limited data on this right now, so this is kind of the teaser slide. But perhaps, you know, this salt water coming in is bringing the sulfate, adding to the reduction of this material. And also, as I mentioned, Dr. Osborne is going to answer all these questions for us in the talk after next, because he's going to talk about some of these things that happen as salt water comes in. There are many different things, but for some reason, it enhances the degradation of organic matter. Okay. And summary, as we saw on the 10 and 50-year time scale, the accretion rates are keeping pace. Most recent 10 years, it's not. Storm surge material, adding that phosphorus can help this. And then the last one is just talking about the enhanced mineralization of this organic matter. And in some areas, people start to refer to this as peak collapse. And maybe we're seeing peak collapse on some type of scale here. And all the different co-authors and the sponsors of my research. Thank you. Subsidence of land?
Yes.
The basic bedrock, the subsidence is very low, at least all in the platform in Florida in general. Now, you do see some change in the actual organic material sitting on top of that bedrock. And so you can actually measure that with the SETs. And with the SET data, I tell you, we've got that 15-year period. And it basically does this. It comes up, and boom, Wilma comes in. And that slowly drops back off, and it comes right back on that same line. Okay, so there's not really a whole lot of subsidence taking place there.